It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And we have live in the studios with us once again, as we do each week, both Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. How are you both this morning?
Fine. Jav, sit up.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I'm good.
Yep.
We're awake now.
Hi, Ralph. I'm sorry, Fred.
All right.
I'm very well.
It's good to have you both here.
In body and spirit.
Yes. So a really busy week, you know, in a lot of different ways.
We keep saying that every week.
We do.
I think the whole world keeps speeding up.
We're just getting older, one or the other.
I think both.
Yeah, since we're not getting younger. So
literally. Locally, there are several activists that have joined the club of being harassed by the Treasury Department.
Well, and not just activists. For people who are coming in late on this score, there's kind of an interesting case that's developing that has quite a few national implications, actually, in terms of it's setting a rather troubling precedent. And it happens to somebody that a number of the people in the audience, at least those who are activists who have been to peace demonstrations or whatnot, would probably recognize. A couple, actually. Guy in town named Tom Warner, who is I guess 77 years old. He's an older gentleman. Been an activist and radical and union organizer and lefty for many years. He literally actually was drummed out of his job in 48 due to the Magnuson Waterfront Security Act. He was in one of those groups that he was supposed to swear that he did not or had not ever belonged to, and he did, and he has ever since. And really, since about the mid 50s. He's been a fan of Fidel Castro and is really, I think, best known in town as being a Cuba activist who works with Material Aid and various groups that go to Cuba in defiance sometimes of the embargo and sometimes licensed for educational purposes and whatnot. And oddly enough, he's gotten himself in trouble in his old age, and it is for something that is not directly related to any of the activism that he himself organizes. But he got a letter a few weeks ago, and also getting letters were Alice Wolt of the Church Council of Greater Seattle and Dwight Pels, our county council person, who's a Democrat, whose district is Rainier Valley and Renton. Pels and Wolt went on a delegation to Cuba this past February as part of a proposal that King County was considering to form a sister county relationship with Grandma Province in Cuba. Seattle has about 20 of these sister city relationships, and King County has a couple, and it sort of becomes standard fare in local politics to have sister city relationships, and the Cuba movement's been trying to do that to sort of establish citizen diplomacy where the governments won't talk to each other. Tacoma has a sister city relationship and so forth. And so a group called the U.S. Cuba Sister Cities Association set this up. And, you know, Warner obviously knew about it, but did not go on the trip. He just, you know, had promoted it on his website and so forth. And so lo and behold, he gets a letter, Wolt and Pels get letters from the Treasury Department, an office in the Treasury Department called the, let's see if I get this acronym right, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, because it's illegal to spend any money in Cuba. You know, you're trading with the enemy, I believe, was the actual act that was covered under, even though they're no longer officially an enemy. And Wolt and Pels get these letters that people who go to Cuba occasionally do, saying, you know, under penalty of $10,000 or whatever, tell us your entire itinerary and where you went in Cuba and send us a copy of your license and so forth. And Wolt replied and took the Fifth Amendment, because the letter also said, you know, tell us everybody who went, and, you know, it's one of these sort of McCarthyite things of all the other people who were involved. And Pels replied, but he replied very perfunctorily. He just literally sent them a copy of his agenda and, you know, the major expenses that he had. Warner, however, sitting here at home in Seattle in the comfort of his home up on the north side, gets a different letter. He gets a letter And I've got a copy of it here that reads as follows, or part of it, the relevant part reads as follows. OFAC has received information that the U.S.-Cuba Sister Cities Association organized a trip described by USCSA as a quote-unquote conference. This was, in fact, the second annual conference that about 300 officials from the two countries went to. A trip described as a conference to Cuba from February 17th to 24th, 2002. Based upon the enclosed internet article, it appears that you were involved with the organizing and or rather the promotion and or possible organization of this conference. OFAC did not issue a specific license to you to organize, arrange, promote, or otherwise facilitate the attendance of persons at the conference in Cuba, nor did OFAC issue a specific license to you to engage in travel-related transactions in Cuba in connection with this conference. And then it goes on to ask Warner to provide the following under penalty of a $20,000 fine. Within 20 business days. Number one, full explanation of each area of involvement that you may have had with the organization, facilitation, and promotion to this conference. Two, contact information for all organizations that were involved in the organization of this conference, as well as a description of the type of involvement for each entity. In other words, naming names. Number three, if you traveled to Cuba for any purpose related to this conference, you must indicate your time of travel to Cuba and list your activities and financial expenditures within Cuba. Number four, all records, sorry, I'm having trouble reading this. It's a very dark photocopy. All records, memorandums, emails, expenditure reports, receipts, etc., that are relevant to the conference. And number five, any additional information that you may wish to disclose. And now, and they also very helpfully sent a photocopy of that internet article, the internet article for which Tom got this $20,000 threat and demand to name names and so forth, was a calendar listing on his website. Now, you can kind of interpret this one of two ways. Either somebody in Washington is very, very thick and thinks that an elderly gentleman in Seattle who is 3,500 miles away from Cuba actually organized this event, called it a trip, elaborately arranged to disguise it as a conference and lured all of these elected officials along on the scam. Or it's a way of harassing somebody for what they posted on the internet. And it's a very, very worrisome kind of precedent. It's an attack on free speech of the type that even groups like the ACLU, which are reluctant to get involved in issues like Cuba because they consider it foreign affairs. They don't want to get involved in international relations kind of things. But it's a question of free speech. It's a question of what can and cannot you post on the internet. And in this case, Warner was not involved in the conference. The conference was fully licensed. OFAC, issues license for these. Most of the people, including Wolves and Pels, had licenses to travel that were considered legal. But even if Warner were involved in something illegal, even if he'd organized the whole thing himself, people put things on the internet all the time that are, for example, calendar listings for events at which people commit civil disobedience, at which they're arrested. Activists have been concerned for quite a while now, actually, that, for instance, federal conspiracy laws, things like RICO, could be used against groups like Ruckus Society or other groups that that do trainings for civil disobedience, or people, for instance, like the folks who organized the blockade during the WTO ministerials. So this seems like a very worrisome precedent. And the laws governing relations with Cuba and trade and whatnot are fairly Byzantine, complicated, and they're not well understood by people who don't pay a lot of attention to Cuba, but it points up a couple things. Number one, how insane our policy toward Cuba is. I've got an article in this that'll be in the Weekly next week, and Dwight Pels had a priceless quote about how it's demonstrating primarily that the administration continues its Cuba travel fetish. And I should mention also, incidentally, that this came up in context of the King County sister city relationship that went down by one vote in October. where it came up for a vote at almost exactly the same time these letters were received. And certainly some of the people involved, Warner and his lawyer, and a number of the Cuba activists in town, think that it was related. OFAC's website has a 1-800 tip line that you can call that's listed on their website. And Kathy Lambert, the very conservative East Side Republican who led the opposition along with veterans groups, she is considered a lead suspect by a lot of these folks. Pels is a bit more circumspect, but certainly the timing was unusual. But, you know, even if it's just this sort of localized thing that was using the mechanism of the federal government to harass an activist, it's sort of a harassment that's a very, very worrisome precedent, and one that people who are concerned about curbs on internet free speech ought to be paying very close attention to. Hmm.
All right. Well, moving along, Henry Kissinger didn't last too long on the panel on
no,
the commission.
No, he didn't.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, when given a choice between serving his country and making more money for his clients, Henry's been a self-interested guy for a very long time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting. He didn't step down because of his past or because of his involvement with the Vietnam War or the bombing of Cambodia,
Chile,
or his support for Operation Condor or his links to the Indonesian government and military.
The lawsuit that's accusing him of being a war criminal.
Right. He stepped down because he didn't want to reveal the list of his clients that his consulting firm handles. And it's interesting because the Bush administration had assured him that he wouldn't have to, and then they turned around and they harassed the panel that was helping set up the commission and the Senate ethics panel that was reviewing whether or not the members of the commission would have to go through financial disclosure and list who their clients were and how much they received from different companies and so forth.
I was going to mention something about this, that it's been very striking to me that in the coverage of this, nobody has questioned why it is that people like Kissinger and George Mitchell, who also resigned this week, assumed going in, as many of these sort of, you know, power broker DC type folks do, that they wouldn't have to make those disclosures. I mean, the laws are all out there.
No, I think it's partly because many of the Bush administration officials haven't had to disclose things. Bush himself hasn't had to disclose his Harkin dealings, and Cheney hasn't had to disclose his who he met with when he was helping to formulate the Bush administration's energy policy. They've been able to escape a lot of disclosure themselves. And then when they appoint these people, they assure them, well, you're a presidential appointee, you don't have to tell, you know, and that's what they told Kissinger.
Well, but they certainly have to disclose their financial interests and who they would have potential conflicts of interest with when dealing. They do that when they're running for office, in the case of people like Bush and Cheney.
Yeah, but a presidential appointee is not really running for office.
No, but all of the cabinet nominees have had to do that too. But
yeah.
Anyway, yeah,
but
it's just a very interesting assumption to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's all wrapped up in the secretive nature of the Bush administration, and Kissinger fit right into that. And, of course, when Democrats and then Republicans said, no, wait, you're going to have to do some financial disclosure, and then families of the 9/11 victims said, no, we're concerned because we think Kissinger has a lot of foreign clients and he won't want to offend people from these various foreign governments, and he finally decided, well, no, I don't want to tell anything. He had at first said, I will reveal a list to a third party, that would not release it to the public. And then that third party would be able to determine whether or not there were any conflicts of interest. But even
My
that
wife.
Was too much. Yeah, even that was too much. So that's a pretty interesting development. And it will be interesting to see who the Bush administration comes up with to replace him. The Democrats have picked all their appointees to that committee, but the Republicans have only picked one. And I think Jav will tell you a little more about it.
Yes, and the drum roll, please. His name is Slade Gordon. And folks may remember Slade. He's the guy who works for us, as you recall. Well, now he works for George W. And it again is you know, very telling that, you know, Slade, who ran for office for lo these many years as an outsider, even though he's a career office holder, you know, I'm not part of the D.C. establishment, yada yada, even though he had got all of this, you know, corporate money and so forth. Well, now he turns out to very much be the corporate insider in his old age. And he also, it would be very interesting to see a full disclosure of the list of his employer, which is Preston Gates Ellis, which is, you know, the big 800-pound elephant law firm here in town. They're one of Boeing's biggest law firms. They really made possible the sweatshop set up on the Northern Marianas Islands. A number of the factory owners there and the actual territorial government, I believe, also was one among their clients. And, you know, they do some good things. They do some very, very bad things. That's the nature of a law firm with definitely hundreds, maybe even a couple of thousand of lawyers. I mean, it's a huge firm. But they snapped Gorton up as one of their inside D.C. power broker types as soon as he lost his election to Cantwell after 2000. And it's been very interesting to me that that appointment has not gotten a whole lot of attention in local media. It's gotten a little bit, but then it just sort of disappeared very quickly. It's not seen as any kind of a local story. And I just thought that was kind of fascinating.
And it's interesting that the families of the 9/11 victims have expressed some uneasiness with Slade Gorton being on the panel because of his connections to the Boeing company.
Yeah, and that's not just because they're skittish about airplanes, but the concerns about conflict of interest around 9/11 go in a number of different directions. They go in the direction of airports and airplanes and airline
security, safety, yeah.
Security and safety. They go in the direction of, you know, the various conspiracy theories that are out there in the Middle East and ties to oil. They go in the direction of political power playing. And people in both parties wanting to cover their butts and not have any revelations that people knew things beforehand or had intelligence information that they should have known meant something and didn't.
Yeah, and they go in the direction of involvement of foreign nationals from various countries that might have not been scrutinized very closely because we trade very heavily with certain governments like Saudi Arabia, for example.
So what it boils down to is that anybody who's anybody in D.C., you know, D.C. being sort of the revolving door between corporate America and the administration and both Congress and the executive branch that it is, and we'll talk more about the executive branch appointees and that revolving door in a minute, I think. Mm-hmm. But being the revolving door that it is, it's really hard to find anybody that either the Democrats or the Republicans consider suitably prestigious for this who didn't, number one, originally have public office, and then when they left public office, usually either because they retired or because they were drummed out of office by the voters, they didn't then immediately turn around and, you know, snap up board appointments to six different large corporations and about three law firms, or in the case of Kissinger, set up his own shop. All of these different people who are coming in. Lee Hamilton's name is I think he's on or is expected to come on as Kissinger's replacement now. All of these people have tremendous potential conflicts of interest because they all cash in on their public service and they all use it to make money for themselves and for large corporations that might have potential conflicts of interest.
Yeah, it's very few of them that go on to further public service work in, say, a nonprofit or an NGO or something like that, because it just does not pay very much.
Yeah, I think you could probably count them on one hand. there are at least three new faces in the White House now.
There are.
And they're not the parole officers for the twins.
Yeah, we're not counting them.
We could only hope. No, they're Bush's new economic team. And it's interesting because he's replaced his old economic team with a new economic team that looks in many ways very similar to the old one. The new Treasury Secretary, John Snow, is very similar to Paul O'Neill, except that he's a lot slicker. He's a lot more familiar with politics, and he comes off a lot better in press conferences. Snow has 20 years of work with the Republican Party in various fundraising activities, so his connections are very good. He actually, I think, understands the economy a bit better than Paul O'Neill. O'Neill had a BA in economics that he got back in the 50s, and so I think his understanding of modern markets was very, very poor, whereas Snow has a PhD and has been running and sitting on the boards of various companies for years. Snow has sat on the corporate boards of, he is a former board member for Textron, for Nations Bank, which is now Bank of America. His current board appointments are Verizon, Circuit City, U.S. Steel, Johnson & Johnson, and Sapient Corp. So this is a guy who's pretty busy.
Yeah, and when you see the media accounts that describe this guy as, oh, he's a railroad guy, well, it's not quite that simple.
Right.
You know, he runs big companies of which, you know, the trinkets that get sold in this case are freight movement and railroads.
Right. And during his tenure as CEO of CSX Corp., that's the railroad company that the media is referring to, he was responsible for trying to make it a profitable private industry company. He was part of running up debt for CSX Corp by buying a large portion of the Conrail company when it went through its split up. But he didn't integrate it very well, and that caused a lot of freight backups and a lot of problems for the company, and it is still probably considered one of the least efficient railroad companies in the nation, which I don't think says very much for John Snow. But at least John Snow, I think, understands the economy a bit better, though he's going to be very definitely in the Paul O'Neill Bush administration mode of how to handle the economy.
Although it is very interesting that Snow has this long track record of advocating for a balanced budget. And mind you, he was doing that during the Clinton administration as a way to sort of hold that as a hammer over the Democrats. And then lo and behold, Clinton did balance the budget. Now lo and behold, George W. has dramatically unbalanced the budget.
Actually,
once again,
I think you're thinking of Friedman. Friedman is the guy who's very much for
both of them have. Yeah, yeah. Snow is very, very rabid about it in the mid-90s. He hasn't said as much recently.
Yeah, I think recently he's been more for the Republican mode of supply side tax cuts.
Yeah.
Friedman, Bush's top economic advisor to replace Lawrence Lindsay, initially it seems like a puzzling appointment because while Friedman has worked for the investment firm Goldman Sachs and Marsh & McLennan, the insurance company, he's had a lot of contact with Democrats. Clinton had named him as a...
they have cooties?
But Clinton had named him to a board that reexamined the role of intelligence in the post-Cold War era, and then he had appointed him to the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, which I think is kind of interesting. He didn't serve in any economic positions. He served in intelligence positions. Now, Bush kept him in that role when he came to office. Friedman has served as a board member at the Brookings Institution, which is usually considered one of the more liberal think tanks in Washington, D.C. And Friedman is self-identified as a Republican, but he's strongly against deficit spending. He's the vice chairman of the Concord Coalition, which lobbies against budget deficits. So that seems at first an initially puzzling appointment. However, I think it really tells you where Bush is headed with his economic program. He wants to do tax cuts, but he also is concerned about balancing the budget because he knows that he could get his butt booted out of office if he doesn't. So what he's doing is he's got guys who will certainly put forward a tax cut for him, but will want to also trim the deficit, and that's going to mean very severe cuts in social services. And I think that means they're also going to try to raid the Medicare budget.
Yeah,
as well.
And Social Security. There's a lot of really a dramatic increase in recent years in the borrowing that's been done against the Social Security Trust Fund.
I think the Medicare budget is going to come first.
Yeah, no, they're both. I think you're right. The Medicare will come first, but mm-hmm. you know, don't forget Social Security also, because you know they're very much interested in privatizing Social Security, and the main reason they don't so far is because seniors are against it and seniors vote.
Yeah. And the third new guy in the Bush administration is William Donaldson. He's going to head the Securities and Exchange Commission. Of the three, I think this is the most important appointment. Donaldson founded the Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette Investment Company. He served in the Ford administration. And more importantly, he headed the New York Stock Exchange in the 1990s, from 1991 to 1995. Now, there were some problems that came up while he was head of the New York Stock Exchange. The SEC brought an unprecedented administrative action against the big board for allowing floor brokers to use their insider information on large pending stock trends trades in order to buy and sell for their own benefit, which is illegal.
Sort of like what Bush did at Harkin.
Yeah, exactly. And Donaldson clearly knew about it. There was at least one memo that came to light that Donaldson had received about this problem, and he did nothing about it. In fact, the New York Stock Exchange attempted to assert that it was not illegal when it clearly was, and the SEC had slapped them with sanctions for that. Donaldson also was against three different proposals by the SEC that would have that did actually pass and has helped investors. They were the SEC rule called Regulation Fair Disclosure, which is supposed to prevent companies from giving important news that can move markets to just selected investors and analysts. They have to now release it to everybody at the same time. Donaldson was against that. He thought that selected people should get that information first. Donaldson also wanted the SEC to exempt foreign companies from the same accounting standards that U.S. companies have. That's to allow more foreign companies to list on the stock exchange. But that would be very harmful to investors who wouldn't be able to make comparisons about the finances of foreign companies. And then finally, Donaldson did not support trading in decimals instead of fractions. When there was trading in fractions, traders and stockbrokers could take a larger spread at the expense of investors, and now investors actually get more of their money. So Donaldson, it seems to me, is one of those guys. He's well-connected to the Bush family, but he's not going to be a very strong regulator at the SEC at all.
Okay, that was my question, was which position was he going for?
Yeah,
the SEC.
Yeah, he's chairman of the SEC.
Yeah, the guy who replaced Harvey Pitts. And you know, bear in mind that this guy, as well as Snow also, and of course Kissinger, were all Ford administration veterans. I mean, you know, it's very funny. It's sort of like the main theme of the Bush administration is it's like it's code amber. It's like they're all these holdovers from an administration that went into office nearly 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're running out. They're pretty much going to have to step back another administration.
Well, yeah, so it's like, let's hope Bush doesn't get another term.
They tried that with Kissinger, right? They went from the Ford to the Nixon administration.
Yeah, so, well, and Rumsfeld, too. So, no, it's like, let's hope Bush doesn't get a second term because all these guys are going to keel over. I mean, they're going to be in their 80s. It's insane.
All right, well, we only have a few minutes left, and we still had a lot of things to cover, but how about we talk about the U.S. Going in and snagging 12,000 pages of a report this week.
Right. No, there were when the Iraq government made their report on their arms, on their weapons of mass destruction, they made two copies of the report. One copy was given to the inspectors.
They only have two photocopiers that work in the country.
And one was given to the Security Council, or supposed to be given to the Security Council. Now, the Security Council had agreed that all members would receive a complete copy at the same time. But then the Bush administration raised a stink because Syria sits on the Security Council. And they didn't want, supposedly didn't want non-nuclear countries to have a cookbook for making weapons of mass destruction. Particularly, they didn't want Syria to have any details on Iraq's nuclear program. So the Security Council backed off on that and agreed to provide full copies to the five permanent members, the U.S., Britain, France, and China, and Russia, who are assumed to have nuclear programs, so it wouldn't matter whether or not they had the full report. And then the rest of the Security Council members would get an edited version a week later. But it turns out Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice decided that they just didn't want to wait 2 days, 3 days for their copy of the report. And they just decided on the day when the report came to the Security Council that the U.S. would seize that report and then make copies for everybody else and decide how it would be edited and so forth. And I have to tell you, when we ask, you know, why doesn't the rest of the world trust us, this is a very, very clear example when you have the U.S. stepping in, seizing, you know, having been the one power that has really pushed against Iraq and wants to go to war against Iraq and has been so bellicose, stepping in and seizing the report.
And a government that is on record as saying that they will lie. You know, saying that they will put out misinformation and saying that, you know, public perception and what the world thinks is an important part of their, you know, military campaign and security strategy. I mean, you know, you go back to 1991 and the Gulf War and the famous incubator baby story with Kuwait, and we're seeing, propagandizing. Counterpunch mentioned Stephen Zunis in the last half hour that two-thirds of America thinks Iraq was behind 9/11. We have been subjected for the last year to a very sophisticated propaganda campaign, and that could be the groundwork for additional revelations that may or may not be true. And that's why having the U.S. take the sole copy of a report like this is very, very frightening.
Mm. Yeah, I was kind of, when they were talking about that on Counterspin, I was picturing that the U.S. is going to have to start combining some of the previous lies. And so the next one, logical one, would be there's baby incubators massing on the Iraqi border. Waiting to come across. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. This week, talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And if you could, once again, tell people where they can find Eat the State.
You can find Eat the State around town in bookstores, coffee shops, bars, restaurants, any place where you can find free publications.
Or free drinks.
Or free drinks. I wish. But
yeah, I can find that.
Yeah, but if you can't find us around town, you can always look us up on the web. Our address is www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have any tips, questions, comments, or other ideas, you can give us a call if you want to volunteer at 903-9461.
And we should mention the issue coming out this coming week is a fine holiday, or at least year-end tradition of our most and our most overrated and underrated stories of the year. And we kind of compile that each year. So it's
one to look for.
Yeah, so it's coming out on Wednesday.